Welcome to Soundbites, a series about the food we eat. We're going to spend the next year examining the entire system of how food gets to the farm to your table, including the history, politics, health, and environmental concerns, and the economics of wholesome food. You're already familiar with some of the issues. Our neighborhoods have become food deserts, with not a supermarket to be seen around us for miles. Our children are unhealthy with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure showing up at younger and younger ages. Many of us die too young from preventable diseases. We believe it doesn't have to be this way. Over the coming year, we're going to share stories about our food. We'll explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we get there together. I recently moderated a panel discussion following the screenings of the documentary film Food Inc. in Cape Charles, Virginia, and at Salisbury University. Food Inc. looks at our country's current system of food production with a critical eye, while also exploring some alternatives. On our show today, we're going to hear some of the discussion from those panels, including questions and comments from the audience members. The panelists are chicken grower Carol Morrison, farmer Ted Wycall, and two writers, David Kirby, author of Animal Factory, and Mark Winnie, author of Food Rebels, Guerrilla Gardeners, and Smart Cookin' Mamas. The first panelist you'll hear is Carol Morrison, a former Purdue contractor who lost her contract with Purdue for refusing to fully enclose her chicken houses. Here's Carol explaining the transition she made on her farm since the film was shot.
As you all saw in the story, we lost our contract after 23 years, and we were left with a poultry farm of single-purpose buildings that we could do nothing with except either tear it down or find something else to do with it. So we've launched on a new project on the farm, and we are now raising free-range pasture-raised eggs. We have a flock of 550 Rhode Island Red chickens, which are a standard old breed. They're hardy. They love it outside. And actually, chicken farming is fun now.
Chicken farming is fun now, is that?
Yes.
And Ted, I want you to introduce your farm a minute to our listeners. Right. You weren't in the film, but...
Right, okay. let's see. My farm is Green Branch Farm. It's right outside of Salisbury here. First of all, I'd just like to thank the sponsors for an opportunity to speak and represent myself. I'm here representing myself and only myself. And thanks to everybody for coming out tonight. basically, my farm is, we started off 5 years ago, so we're just ending our fifth year now. Still primarily a vegetable farm, start off with vegetables, still do a lot of vegetables. We're 15 acres of vegetables, which is plenty. No desire to go any bigger than that. We raise chickens on pasture for meat. This year we'll probably raise about 4,000 pasture broilers. That is nowhere near the limit of what we could be raising, but given that we do a lot of other things as well, that's a comfortable number for us. We have about 40 head of beef cattle. This year we'll raise somewhere in the order of like 90 free-range pigs, and we do all direct marketing, so no wholesaling. We don't sell to grocery stores. We're not really big enough to do that as of this point and make a living doing it, and I do like the direct marketing aspect of our operation. Just so people have some idea, we're a small farm. I'd say we probably manage about 20 acres intensively, although we do have about 200 acres under management. And on the 20 acres, primarily on that 20 acres, this year we grossed about $300,000. So that's some, I'm not trying to, that's not bragging or patting myself on the back. I just want people to know that we are a serious commercial operation. I mean, it's a lot of volume of food. It's a lot of sales. On average, I'd say in the peak of the season, we're feeding about 1,000 people a week with vegetables and other products. And right now, we're probably, just because of the our markets are closing down. We're probably down to about 500 people a week. Anyway, we believe in soil management, soil science. We've seen a lot of results from that. And we are trying to raise the most healthy and nutritionally dense food possible.
And I do want you all to participate, so please come up, Mike, and we'll get you up here as soon as you want to speak. One of the things we talked about last night, we did this in Cape Charles last night, with a smaller crowd, but it was good, at the Palace Theater. And one of the things that we talked about last night that actually raised, Dave Kirby, you raised, was the issue of health. And we got into it kind of cursorily last night, but I'd like to kind of raise that and hear comments from the audience as well on it a little bit more in depth about what we're talking about here, and what why you changed. Just tell your story and talk a bit about the idea of health and health issues and the food we eat.
Yes, thank you.
I just want to put that out on the table so you can just wrestle with it, agree or disagree.
Well, speaking of agreeing and disagreeing, I understand there are people in this room who are on both sides of this issue. In fact, there's probably more than two sides of this issue. As a journalist, I learned that every good story has two sides. This is a good story. So there were powerful arguments to be made on both sides of the story. And nobody here is calling for the end of industrial farming or CAFOs. What we're talking about is giving consumers information, education, and choice. And before I wrote this book, I'm a guy from Brooklyn. What do I know about farming, right? Nothing. I knew nothing. My eggs came from the supermarket. My chicken came from Purdue. That's what I bought. And that's how I lived. And then I got the idea to write this book, by the way, because of Roxasorn, which you may know is the arsenic-containing feed additive. Bobby Kennedy Jr., who I got to know through my first book, called me and told me that in a little town in Arkansas called Prairie Grove, Tyson and other large producers were adding this arsenic additive to the feed to make the chickens grow faster, I think you saw in the film. Well, that litter was then dry spread around this town on all the fields. I spent 5 days in Prairie Grove. It was five of the most depressing days I've spent in my life, in my career, meeting with person after person after person diagnosed with cancer. There were three 14-year-old boys diagnosed with the rarest form of testicular cancer, all in the same junior high school class. It's in my book. I have researched cancer rates on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. They are through the roof, and in Delaware as well, in the chicken-producing areas. There is talk that this arsenic-containing additive may be or has been eliminated, but I understand maybe not completely. That's what got me interested in this subject in the first place. And my book deals with every aspect of factory farming, both positive and negative, and I do talk about how productive it is and how we are able to feed people for pretty cheaply. And like I said, there were powerful arguments. But when I started to look into the health aspects, and I recently wrote an article on this, and I sat down and I sort of took a step back from my book, and I realized there are three different areas where industrial animal production can be harmful to our health and to environmental health. And the main reason is the sheer concentration of so many animals in one place, where you need to import so many nutrients on site and then manage so much waste that is generated on site and concentrated, as opposed to a sustainable farm. So these three different ways that we can get sick from factory farming are environmental pollution, waste lagoons you probably are familiar with. They off-gas ammonia, methane, hydrogen sulfide, which can literally drive people crazy, make them engage in violent behavior. Ammonia can make your eyes tear. It can cause throat problems. Ammonia can also travel up to 50 miles away and settle into waterways where it converts back into nitrogen, fueling algae blooms and dead zones, which I think you've seen here in the Chesapeake. There's all kinds of ways. There's seepage through the soil, the application of liquefied manure. In Prairie Grove, we had the blowing of dust containing arsenic from the fecal material of these chickens. And here we have chicken trucks that drive down the road filled with chickens that spew dander and feathers, and now Johns Hopkins University has proved antibiotic-resistant pathogens spewing down the road. I live in New York. If you go out to eastern Long Island, the duck trucks, the same thing. White ducks being trucked down the road, it looks like it's snowing in the middle of the summer. so much is coming. So that's one way, and I could go on and on. Much of my book deals with that. Then there are the communicable diseases, the influenzas, the swine flu, which generated originally in a factory farm in North Carolina, circulated for about a decade. The CDC was terrified that this would mutate one more time so that it could eventually jump to people. Pigs are vectors. They mix avian flu, human flu, and swine flu. That's exactly what happened. It looks like at a factory farm in Mexico, this is where this started. Thank God it wasn't the horrible epidemic we were expecting, but it was bad. And tens of thousands of people around the world died. And economic activity was disrupted, and we lost billions of dollars, including in vaccine development that we wouldn't have needed if this disease had. So the economic impact alone of that one communicable disease, which I believe was attributed to factory farming, needs to be taken into account. And then you have, of course, the foodborne illnesses. The most famous one recently was the 500 million eggs that were recalled because of salmonella. Now, an organic farm can have salmonella, E. coli, listeria. Farming can produce these things. On a small, sustainable, or organic farm, you don't have a 500 million eggs contaminated. If a farmer, and a farmer in a smaller operation is much more in tune with his or her animals, they will know when those chickens are sick, when they come down with salmonella. So you wouldn't have 500 million eggs contaminated. You might have a couple hundred or a couple thousand eggs. I could go on about E. coli, and I now realize that E. coli is not only a foodborne illness, it is actually infectious between people. I wrote an article about a young girl who died. She did not eat infected meat. Her grandfather had eaten it, got diagnosed, was in the hospital. They actually waited 3 weeks to bring her in to see her grandfather. They figured he was no longer infectious. He hugged her. She got sick. She died 3 weeks later. So these are serious matters. I know we need to feed ourselves, but our food, MRSA, I didn't even mention. MRSA is coming home in chicken, in pigs, in beef to a lesser extent. You bring that into your home, you leave it on the counter, you cut your finger, your kids lick it and put it to their mouth. You can transmit MRSA, and people are dying from this. And it's coming not just from hospitals, but it's coming from pig farms and chicken farms, and almost exclusively industrial pig farms and chicken farms. So, again, what is the cost of that 99 cent a pound chicken or pork if you're adding in all these environmental costs, all these communicable diseases, what happened with swine flu, and what happens with E. coli, listeria, salmonella? People die, it costs a lot of money, and suddenly that cheap food isn't quite as cheap.
Carol?
Well, I agree with everything that David is saying, and I know that we need to feed people. In my opinion, I think there are better ways. When you have thousands or hundreds of thousands of animals crammed into a space with less than a square foot of living space for their entire life, you're going to have diseases that are going to spread. Some of the things that you talked about, the arsenic, the antibiotics and whatnot, we've been told that some companies have stopped the practice. They're not doing it anymore. However, other companies are. And we were even told last night at the forum that by a Purdue grower that they had taken arsenic out of the feed and now it's back in. Excuse me?
That's not right.
How do you know?
Well, we can't, just a second. Yeah, we can't,
yes,
have
please.
Back and forth in the audience.
By the way, it's great to see you, Bill.
Carol, pleasure. I'm Bill Satterfield. I'm the executive director of the Chicken Trade Association, Delmarva Poultry Industry Incorporated. I'll hunch down. We could be here for days discussing some of these things. In May, let's talk about arsenic, a product called Roxarsone, an animal health product that contains one atom of arsenic. The Federal Food and Drug Administration announced in May, in cooperation with the manufacturer, Pfizer, that Roxarzone would no longer be sold in the United States, and the chicken companies that had been using it were given a little bit of time to wean it through their system to develop a new program for the health of the birds. It is not being sold. It is not being used in the United States by order of the Federal Food and Drug Administration.
Are you familiar with 3-nitro?
3-nitro is Roxarzone.
Exactly.
It's not being manufactured, and it's not being sold and used in the chicken industry in the United States.
Are any other arsenicals being used?
It is not being used, and it is not being sold. You may have old bags. It is not. It is ill.
Folks.
What is this?
I don't know where you got this. What I'm telling you is that the.
Hey, Ron, the what is this?
I don't know where you got that.
Bill, hold up. Wait, stop.
All right. Well, he interrupted me.
I understand. You can finish your statement.
Yeah, please.
What we're not going to do tonight is have people yell on the screen from the audience back and forth.
I appreciate it.
All right. You can be heard. We all can be heard.
The Federal Food and Drug Administration announced in May that it was not allowing the sale or manufacture of Roxarzone. The chicken companies were given time to use up what they had to develop a better health program. It was a bird health product. Where this gentleman got his product or when, I have no idea.
He actually got it tonight.
Well, I don't know where he got it. I don't know if he's using it. It's coming from
the commercial
chicken company.
Okay, well, I mean, I'm just saying, you know, I'm not going to argue.
The gentleman said it's being phased out, so it's
possible. Yeah, and I think that's great. Yeah. I really do.
And that's what the FDA said.
But
that's
the thing
what the
is,
you need to
let the growers know, because this came right from the horse's mouth last night at our forum.
Well, I don't know who told you that.
It was a Purdue grower. What was his name? Lovell?
Dave
Lovell.
Yes.
But the companies are not. Purdue had not been using the product.
Oh,
for
I understand
years.
What they've been saying.
I know what they've been doing. They've not
are
been
you,
using the product.
Are you privy to their feed formula?
I trust the people.
It is a trade secret.
I
nobody's
trust
privy
the people
to that.
Who work for Purdue.
Can I say that Tyson Chicken removed all arsenic from its feed in 2005, and not a single pediatric case of cancer has been reported in Prairie Grove since then. Mm-hmm. So let's hope the elimination
yes, we,
of this
I certainly
product
hope
here
that is true.
If
will
it
lead
serves
to
the public
same.
Good, more power to
yes.
To the suspect.
Well, then we all agree.
Yes.
That's
yeah.
great.
But we agree.
It's an animal health product to protect the health of the bird, to improve the welfare of the animal, to reduce salmonella in the chickens for food safety reasons. But it's been phased out.
Okay.
And I will also
well,
say...
Well, no, I'm just repeating what we were told last night. It came right, you know, from a grower.
Well, I'm not sure he knows the formula either.
Well, but he said he had been told that it was back in again.
I cannot believe that. I cannot
But
believe
I will also point out that for years, the FDA tested chicken livers
okay.
and said that the arsenic found in chicken livers was not of concern, and therefore there was no need to test the actual meat. But when they did test the actual meat, that's when in May, they said we found arsenic... Yes. In the product that people are actually eating, and that's why we recommend them.
The FDA found arsenic residues in the livers.
Okay, you know, Bill, I want to explain something to you.
Than were 30 years ago.
I would like to explain something
Please.
To you. For 23 years, I was exposed to arsenic unknowingly. I have a problem with that, and I think every grower should have a problem with that because arsenic is poison.
It can be.
It's a carcinogen. It can be. I think Prairie Grove is. But my point is, I had the right to know what I was being exposed to, and I was not told.
Did you ask?
It's a trade secret.
Did you
the
ask?
FDA can, yes, I've asked many times what is in the feed. The FDA cannot even get the feed ingredients because Purdue, Tyson, all of them are protected under trade secrets.
I will let others.
Nobody knows so feed formulas so, except the company.
So let me ask this question. So I think that the issue raised here is also not just a health question, it's a political question.
Yes.
Right?
Most definitely.
So then what happens with that? I mean, as you said earlier, Ted, and you said the other night, last night, that for you this is not your style of farming versus CAFO farming. This is not, but it needs to be a more even playing field is what you were talking about last night. So the question is, A, what do you do about what we're talking about in terms of trade secrets and what happens inside of businesses? then we'll come to the other piece about how you create a level playing field.
Well, I don't know anything about arsenic, even though I don't want to go anywhere near it. But I do know that consumers have the right to know, and that's been a battle. It's been an uphill battle for a long, long time. And we all try to struggle as consumers. I'm not a farmer. I'm a consumer. I try to devote a fair amount of my time to understanding what's in food, how it's been grown, what's happened to it from the point of the farm to the time that it ends up in my kitchen. And it hasn't been easy for a lot of us to do that. So that's one reason that we've been looking for these so-called alternatives. We want organic food or sustainable food. We're very, very suspicious of the industrial food system. And there's another part to it, and I think part of the reason that we get confused as consumers is because we're not paying attention as citizens. You know, we're trying to be good food consumers, but we're not very good food citizens. And part of the reason, I think, and I've seen this play itself out in state legislatures, I see it play itself out in Congress, is that we don't have a voice in how our food is produced. We have to fight tooth and nail. And I want to illustrate that with my little prop that I carry around with me. You can see that it's just a little tube of chapstick. And Carol, would you just tell me what's
in it? No, I can't see.
You can't see?
Actually, it says Monsanto.
This is Monsanto chapstick. Now, it's not produced by Monsanto. It's not genetically modified chapstick. It won't hurt you. I even use it on my lips, and I haven't lost my lips yet. But this chapstick was inside this backpack, or what's left of this backpack, along with a lot of publications from Monsanto, from Syngenta, from ADM, from ConAgra. And it says on the backpack, Legislative Agriculture Chair Summit. This was at an event that was held in Arizona last January, where all the chair people, the elected officials in your state legislatures who chair your state ag committees, basically the committees that make a lot of the decisions about our food and farming, were all invited to this conference. They were all paid for by Monsanto, by ConAgra, by ADM, and they got lots of material, including this chapstick inside this backpack. That concerns me. It concerns me because, you know, those who have the most political power, in this case the elected officials, are being wined and dined by the industry, who has an obvious interest in what goes on in those legislatures, what kind of rules are going to be made, whether or not you're going to get arsenic out of chicken feet, whether or not you're going to have information on labels about what's in food, information about whether you can be protected, if you're a property owner and in some way you can be protected from GMO crops. It goes on and on and on. I mean, just as one example, David mentioned, you know, the eggs and salmonella was a recent, one of the most recent food safety failures in our system. There's a booklet that was in this backpack. It's called American Egg Farming. And it says, how we produce an abundance of affordable, safe food. Okay, sounds good. But down at the bottom it says, how animal activists may limit our ability to feed our nation and world. So the point of this is to try to, in this case, was to advise the elected officials that so-called activists, who tend to be citizens, I mean, activists are sort of the pejorative term sometimes for people like you and me who actually have the right to come before our elected officials and try to persuade them to do one thing or another. Well, one thing that's happening now, of course, as you saw it in the movie, is that you know, people will get inside of factory farms, and they'll take photographs, and they'll put those photographs and that video up on YouTube. And the owners of those operations usually don't like that to happen because those operations tend to be not terribly appealing to people who are outside, people who generally are not farmers. And they're trying to make laws now that would criminalize that activity. That's the activists. Those are the people that the egg industry wants to go after. We're seeing a number of states that are using preemptive legislation, which basically means that the state takes the right away from a city or municipality that wants to try to create some laws with respect to regulations with respect to food. We've seen this recently in Cleveland, where the Ohio took away its right to be able to eliminate trans fats from the food there. We see it recently in Oklahoma, where the state of Oklahoma took the right of municipalities to protect property owners from GMOs, and we're seeing it in other places as well. It's a very aggressive move right now on the part of the industry to secure even more control and to fight back those so-called activists, those citizens, and push them back. The American Farm Bureau has put together a $30 million a war chest to try to persuade the public that the food that they're producing is safe, healthy, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not going to say that all the food produced by the industrial food system is unsafe or unhealthy. But obviously they feel pretty nervous that they're going to have to put up $30 million just to persuade us to buy their food. This isn't a branding operation. This is simply to say the food we're producing is okay. And at the same time, take the pressure off of them from our lawmakers and from citizens and from activists who really all they want is to have some say, some control over the food they eat. Isn't that something that's allowed in this country? Why do we, last I heard, this is a democracy, and we do have the right to be heard. But when we go up against people who amass a tremendous amount of money and are incredibly influential politically, then it's not a level playing field.
Ted Wycall.
All right. I was always taught this was a democracy, and I'm not so sure anymore. I'm out there trying to make a living farming, and people are curious as to what is in their food, and I'm glad to show people how we raise birds, and they can come on my farm. They can go through my cabinets. I don't care. I'm totally transparent. You want to see it, you got it. And I have to go up against and compete against industries that will not allow that to happen, and then to add insult to injury, produce television commercials that show chickens in nice timber frame barns that are just beautiful and immaculate, and you got four chickens and 500 square feet running around with straw bales and jumping around and having a good time, and that's what they're trying to portray is what goes on. What we're up against, small farms, is entrenched interests that have a lot of money, have a lot of sway with politicians, and can get regulations put into place to help stomp out competition, especially from small family farms like myself. You would not believe the number of regulations that I have to abide by. I'm sure that the industry does as well, but just to give you an example, I have to have three licenses to be able to kill chickens on my farm that I've grown. I have to have a license to put it in my refrigerator. I have to have a license to transport it down the road, and I have to have a license to be able to process on farm. It also is a staggering amount of paperwork that I have to do, and because of all this, I choose not to sell chickens off of my farm. I avoid all of that by selling on my farm, and that's it. Believe me, 4,000 chickens is a lot, but we could be producing a heck of a lot more, and especially if we could cross state lines. I can't do that either. essentially... we're kind of pigeonholed in that way, but the revolving door is something of great concern. I believe in free market capitalism, and you cannot have a free market when you have collusion of industrial and political interests, as well as a veil of secrecy over the industry.
That was Ted Wycall, who, along with his wife, runs Green Branch Farm in Salisbury, Maryland. You're listening to Soundbites on Delmarva. Today's show is taken from panel discussions I moderated following a recent screening of the documentary film Food Inc. in Cape Charles and in Salisbury. We'll be right back with more after this short break.
Welcome back to Soundbites on Delmarva. Today's show is taken from the panel discussion I moderated following recent screenings of the documentary film Food, Inc. in Cape Charles, Virginia and Salisbury, Maryland. The panelists are chicken grower Carol Morrison, farmer Ted Wyckoff, and two writers, David Kirby, author of Animal Factory, and Mark Winnie, author of Food Rebels, Guerrilla Gardeners, and Smart Cooking Mamas. And now it's time to get back to our panel discussion. In the film, there was a scene with a family making decisions about what to buy and what things cost. So, come on up. You can come next. So the question is, I have for you all is, how do you create a system where food is affordable? I mean, we had a little difference here between the two of you last night, which is interesting, over the issue of subsidies. And I think that's an interesting discussion to have. But how do you create one of the things that large-scale farming has done is made meat affordable. I mean, was the Coolidge around for president and said a chicken in every pot?
Mm-hmm. And now we don't have enough pots for the chickens.
But he said that because people wanted food. They wanted meat on their table. And people couldn't afford chicken. Right? So how do we create a system where the carrot doesn't cost more than a McDonald's family meal?
Can I speak a little to that?
Go right ahead.
I go to that in the book as well. And again, it's not about eliminating CAFOs, and I think we'll talk about that later. We believe that the price of oil will eventually eliminate CAFOs, but that may be several decades away, and we can get into why that will happen. But we're talking about alternatives. We're talking about helping out small independent farmers who aren't contracted with large corporations. And in my book, I list a lot of the ways that people who are concerned about this are trying to address the situation. One of them was a certain senator from Illinois, who you may know, who was running for president and who won the Iowa caucus based hugely on an anti-CAFO reform platform. And my belief is that if he had not done this, he would have lost, and we may have a President Clinton right now and a Secretary of State Obama. But Barack Obama was trying to out John Edwards on this issue. And he came up with a rural agenda for America, and it was every anti-CAFO activist's dream, and included things like opening up the bottleneck in processing plants, which used to be all over. We had regional plants all over the place. Now we have one servicing maybe a state or two states or three states. And if that farmer, independent farmer, wants to have his or her animals processed, it's very, very difficult to get those animals in because the large growers basically have a monopoly with a processing plant, which is often owned by the same company that owns the animals. There was supposed to be a ban on that. It's called the Packer ban. Obama campaigned to enforce that ban. It was a Republican bill, by the way, from President Harding. It has not been enforced. Obama promised to back a bill to ban the use of antibiotics in industry, not to treat sick animals, but to promote growth. He's basically backed off that. That bill has languished in Congress. If we were to eliminate the use of non-therapeutic antibiotic use, that would, again, level the playing field. So it's all about making sure that the smaller producers can compete with the larger producers. Subsidies, most of those go to grain, to meat, to dairy. Very little go to smaller producers. Very little go to funding smaller processing plants. There's a whole list of things. I encourage you all to go on. I'm not advocating for one party or one candidate. I'm just saying what our president promised he would do as a candidate. And his rural agenda still is up online. Take a look at it. It's pretty important. Now, those are the political legislative things. What can we do as citizens? There's all kinds of things. If you're concerned, if you don't want to completely support the industrial model and would like to feed yourself and your family with at least some alternatives, there are things you can do. You might want to choose one protein that you're going to switch over. Eggs, let's say. Commercial eggs cost about $2 a dozen. Organic eggs cost about $4 a dozen. Now, I don't have a huge family to feed. For me to spend 12 cents more an egg or whatever it is worth it to me. I also joined my local food co-op in Brooklyn, where in exchange for working 3 hours a month, I get access to local, sustainably raised produce, dairy, and meat at a very significant discount, way below Whole Foods. and I'm able to shop there and I can afford it. So my point is that there are steps we can take as citizens, there are steps we can take as consumers, and even small steps can make a difference.
Could I chime in just quickly on that?
Go ahead.
Okay. First of all, I think that we all have to own that question of, you know, how are we going to feed a hungry world? And we know there's going to be at least 9 billion people on the planet by the year 2050. None of the question or the answer to how we feed a hungry world should be put on the shoulders of farmers. It's not a case of farmers coming up with cheaper food or having to take, you know, take some kind of reduction in the price that they get for their food in order to feed the world. That's not necessarily their problem. That's a problem that we all share, and it's one that I think we have to look at in terms of public responsibility and also public sector participation. You know, a lot of you have heard about the subsidies, and that was in the film, the subsidies that go into certain products. Well, one thing is, you know, that just keep this image in mind. You all know, you know, the government comes out with recommendations about what you should eat and how much, what the proportions are. You know, the last one was a pyramid, and we were supposed to eat a certain amount of food from the top down to the bottom, 5 to 9 servings a day, for instance, of fruits and vegetables. Well, now they came up with a plate instead. They like the plate idea. I don't know why the plate's better than the pyramid, maybe because it's hard to eat off a triangular plate, maybe. I'm not sure. But the recommendation is that half of that plate should be fruits and vegetables. That's pretty easy, I guess, to figure that out. Well, look at our subsidies in this country. 2% of our subsidies go to fruits and vegetables. If you're going to eat half of that plate is green and orange and so forth, why are we only putting 2% of our subsidies into that portion? So that's part of the question, or a part of the, you know, the question, problem, challenge of how we feed a hungry world. How do we make food affordable? How do we make particularly healthy, the healthiest food affordable and available to people? I spent 25 years of my career working in a low-income community where my job was to try to figure out how to get good, healthy food available to some very poor people. And I did it in all kinds of ways. I was amazed at how inventive people could be in order to achieve that end. But a big part of my effort was connecting farmers to those people and finding a way to close the gap between those farmers who wanted a better price for their food and lower income people that needed to get healthy food at an affordable price. And we did pretty damn well.
Please, identify.
I hope we'll stay on this topic of legislative activism and individual activism, but I wanted to just note that it's interesting that a lot of the food education that's coming out and discussion of food politics is coming out through books like Schlosser's and Pollan's and the two authors here, and also movies. And it's interesting to note that the high-quality journalism we're not seeing in the newspapers, especially the local newspapers. And I think just as politicians are influenced by lobbyists, it's very possible that local newspapers are influenced by the industries that are part of the community.
I think I need to agree with you on that, especially here locally.
Is Kathy Phillips here? Kathy? Yeah. You tried to publicize this event, correct?
Yes.
Can you tell us what result you got?
Out of two press releases and some phone calls, no one in the print media posted anything over the past 2 weeks. And when the first press release didn't show up, I thought, okay, they're going to wait until the week prior to the event and run it. And then it didn't run last week. So by Friday, when all the weeklies came out, I realized that I had to do something. And so thankfully, with my funding from Town Creek, I kind of moved some things around in the budget. And I purchased airtime on the local public radio so that ads would run over the weekend and Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And hopefully that's how some of you found out about it tonight. But it is a problem. And I do want to give credit to Channel 47 WMDT because they did show up tonight. And there's going to be something on the 10 o'clock and 11 o'clock news. So I want to credit them.
Good evening, Mark.
Jim, good to see you.
Nice to see you. Nice to see you, Ted. Thank you all for taking the time tonight to show us the movie. he brought up a lot of good points about some flaws in our whole food system. I'd like to get some of your input as to what you think the solution to this is. I hear the main theme so far has been organic or pseudo-organic as being the solution. The UNFAO, United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, did a study that said in order to maintain the current levels of production in the United States, it's going to require over 100 million additional workers on farm, meaning farmers and farm laborers. I looked it up tonight before I came here. Our current workforce is about 157 eligible workers. So we're looking at two-thirds of the American population, working population, being committed to agricultural production. So what are your thoughts as to whether that's feasible, whether we can stand to lose two-thirds of our nurses, teachers, and other professions to commit to digging carrots or cleaning out hog pens? And then follow up with an address on the comments made by Norman Borlaug, the father of the Green Revolution. He's also a Nobel laureate, who published that if we converted the entire world, all the land that was available, all the arable land, to organic production, we could only feed 4 billion people. In April, we're going to cross the 7 billion people mark. So who chooses the 3 billion that starve?
Can I take this? Go ahead, Carol.
So, Carol, I'll go to Ted.
All right.
I hear what you're saying, and I think maybe the message might be a little bit cross because organic is not the only way to do it, and that's not what's being pushed.
And that's what I'm trying to encourage here.
Yes,
what is your vision as what should be pushed?
There are
what
several,
is the ideal picture?
There's several different ways to produce our food. You can have very small farms. You can have medium-sized farms, or you can have really large farms. They can all produce food. As far as the workforce goes, our unemployment rate is almost 10%, correct?
Correct.
I think we could put Americans back to work.
100 million additional ones?
I don't think we'll need 100 million. Although I'm concerned about other countries having enough food to eat, I think that it's time that we started thinking about America first.
I agree.
We do need to take care of ourselves as well.
No question.
Yes.
Now, I mean, but again, where is the labor coming from?
Well,
what are we going to sacrifice?
Are you saying 100 million Americans would have to be?
According to the United Nations study.
To feed the world.
To maintain the current level of U.S. production. So to make sure the commodities produced are in the same quantity as what we are now. Not necessarily the same commodities, but the same volume of food. It would require an additional 100 million laborers.
And I will say, too, that we're not saying...
UN produces it. It's about as non-biased as you can get.
I don't think that any of us is saying that, let's kill industrial agriculture. In my opinion, if the large-scale CAFOs, if you will, if they want to continue, well, I'm happy for them. They will implode on themselves because it is becoming way too expensive to operate in the system that they're operating in. And if all the subsidies are taken away, so when you add in the health cost, the social cost, and the environmental cost that taxpayers are paying, let's take all that away and see how long they survive.
No question.
Okay. So we need to think about where we're going to put our subsidies into things that can produce food, not in a system that is going down.
And that's what I'm asking.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, Ted is a perfect example. Okay.
Ted and I don't differ all that much.
Yes.
Because we're competitors.
Well, that's great.
In the same
yes.
market. And Ted and I consider Ted a friend of mine.
And that's good because I think in my travels in the last year, I've had the opportunity to go all over this country and see many, many different types of farming. That's what finally convinced me to do what I'm doing now. There's many ways. Doesn't have to be organic. Nobody said organic. If you want organic, well, fine. You have that choice. And this is what we are saying. There are many different choices to make for farmers, and there are many different choices to make for consumers. Up until recently, we have not had those choices. So let's see where this goes.
Could I throw him up? We'll have dueling Nobel laureates, all right?
Okay.
So yeah, you brought out your guy. I'll bring out my guy. Amartya Sen, who is a Nobel laureate economist, studied famine, poverty, development in the developing world, political economy, political systems. And his conclusion after his research, and part of the reason he won a Nobel Prize, was that in no country where you have a functioning democracy, where you have transparency, where you have accountability, where a free press, people know what's going on, in other words, have you ever had a famine, even in a poor country? So I kind of come away from the question not looking at how do we, you know, redesign farming systems and more technology,
yeah,
but how do we promote more participation by our citizens? You know, here's just a crazy idea. You know, what if we all sat down, you know, if we sat down with the, you know, the large-scale producers and the people that have, say, and the consumers and say, gosh, you know, there's some parts of this food I just don't, or some parts of your production that really concern me. Can we figure out a different way to do that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do we begin to engage government more effectively so that we're not always pulling and tugging and trying to make, you know, trying to get them to, you know, support one interest over another? So I still believe in this concept of democracy, and maybe that's the idea. Maybe that's the way that we can promote better communication, better transparency, and we all share that responsibility for that question,
yeah,
that you proposed, and it's an incredibly important question.
So,
oh, yeah.
Tip. Let me get you.
All right. Well, this is book stuff, man. We got to go through it piece by piece. We have to look at, let's look at vegetable farms, let's look at grain farms, let's look at hog farms, chicken farms, every beef, you know, let's go through it, each single one. Okay. Growing organically is kind of a nebulous term. It doesn't really, it's not a blanket statement. You know, organic beef is not the same thing as organic vegetables. They don't match up. So, mm-hmm, essentially, we can do some math, but as far as vegetables go, you're always going to have a huge labor force. It doesn't matter. That's just what vegetable farming is. It's a lot of labor on the ground. It doesn't matter if it's conventional or organic. If we're growing as much vegetables as we have, I'm not saying that we need to go back to plowing with mules and, digging carrots and potatoes with a spading fork. That's not my idea of a good time, all right? plowing with mules is pretty cool, actually. But anyway, mechanization is what cuts down on labor. It's not organic or conventional. It's mechanization. Nobody's arguing against mechanization, okay? So that's how we address that argument with the labor. Okay?
As an ag engineer that deals with vegetable harvest mechanization, there's not all the problems in the world cannot be solved with machines.
True.
You can't pick a tomato with a robot. Yes.
Okay, sure.
Maybe,
sure.
Maybe down the road.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you willing to make the investment as a taxpayer into making that robot to support that industry? Or are you going to prefer the cheaper tomato in Walmart that is hand-picked under the current system? We're looking at a whole.
This is an important issue. Let's wrestle this next few minutes before you. Yeah.
Well, for example, have something to do with it for weed control. That would be an example of one.
So let's take organic off the table for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Put it over here. We're talking about the question Jim raised. I think it's an important question: is how do we feed America? We saw in the film. It happens every day. I see it every day, where people who are working people who don't make a lot of money cannot afford to buy decent food. That's a reality. Mm-hmm. McDonald's hamburgers are a lot cheaper. Then go on to buy yourself a head of lettuce and broccoli and go on home and cooking it. And people don't have time to do it if they're working three or four jobs to keep a roof over their heads. That's reality. So the question is, how do we feed? What is the system that we're talking about at this table that came out of this film? How do we feed America? What do we do? Stephen, take the rest of the world off the table for a minute.
How do we
feed America?
Can I say something? Because we are in the middle of the biggest jobs crisis in this country since the Great Depression. People need work. And It's so interesting because usually what I hear out of industry is bragging that 2% of the population produces 100% of the food in this country. And you never hear the auto industry bragging about how few people they employ, or any other industry brag about how few people they employ because they're so productive and so efficient. But what if we could somehow double or even, let's say, triple that? Now, I don't think we're going to get to 30%. I personally don't think we need to get to 30%. But why limit it to 2%? We have all these people out of work. We have plenty of land in this country. And we have farm families who are basically, their children aren't taking over the farm, and so we lose a farm. Whereas if we got those children involved in farming, we could double the number of farms. We could increase competition. We could lower prices. And I guess my point is that if we need to create jobs and economic activity in this country, I think agriculture is a really promising sector. So instead of trying to reach some philosophical or theoretical goal of 100 million people, why don't we aim for what would 12% be? 36 million people, or whatever that would work out to be.
To address one little point, as far as the inheritance to the younger generation, the reason they're not doing it is because it's not profitable.
Exactly.
If you make it profitable, the people will go there. Now, there's a whole host of issues as to why farming is not profitable, and I'm going to leave you with that.
I'd also just like to say about the land issue. I went all over the country to research this book. If you go to Iowa, for example, beautiful, rich, gorgeous farmland, it's all corn and soybean. That's all they grow because it's going to feed the animals. So if you take some of that acreage off and put it into fruits and vegetables and row crops, again, you level the playing field a little bit more.
You want to finish that tip before we go to the next
one? Yeah. That was James brought up a huge, huge volume of information that needs to be addressed. And so I think we could spend, like, days going through all that. But essentially, you know, there are studies that say organic yields higher. And from my own personal experience, I don't see how we could yield any higher using conventional fertilizer. I don't see it. We don't have hardly any loss economic damage from insects. We spray organic insecticides maybe 5 or 6 times a year. We don't have economic issues or economic losses from pests. We don't use herbicides. It would be nice to have that tool in our chest, and you can use organic herbicides. They are expensive, so we would have to charge more for food. Organic food costs more because supply and demand. The supply is low, the demand is high, and therefore you sell your food to the highest bidder. So this argument that organic food is more expensive and we can't feed people that way is because there's not that many organic farms, not that many organic farmers, and there's a lot of people that want it. So, you know, if I could sell a pound of tomatoes for $100 and I'm selling all my tomatoes, I'm going to raise the price. Okay? So it doesn't matter. I mean, that's just the reality of economics. So until we actually have more organic farms and there's more organic food in the marketplace, we're not going to see the prices going down. Now, that's under current and past conditions. Let's look at future conditions. The problem with the Green Revolution and Norman Borlaug's system of farming is that you take what is production agriculture, you marry it to fossil fuels. The problem with that is that fossil fuels is a finite resource. There is not an infinite amount of oil in the earth. Okay? So what the problem is that when that resource starts to deplete, then what are we going to do? We can't – I mean, you know, for every 7 calories of – for every calorie of food in the Green Revolution food production system, we use over 7 calories of petroleum to get 1 calorie of food. That is a net energy loss. Okay, and what it all boils down to is the laws of thermodynamics and net energy. And when you look at that, we are in big trouble because if we use that much petroleum in our food system, what's going to happen when oil starts to go down? And guess what? The world has not produced any more oil, even though demand is higher, than since 2005. So if you look into it, there's a term called peak oil, and I really encourage every single person to do your own research, and I mean as soon as you get home, because it is very important. We need to look at what peak oil is and how that is going to affect our food supply. If we don't start to transition into a new method of farming, we're going to be in big trouble, and it's not going to be that far away.
That's all we have time for today, and thanks to all of our panelists from today's show, chicken grower Carol Morrison, farmer Ted Wyckoff, and 2 writers, David Kirby, author of Animal Factory,
and Mark Winnie, author of Food Rebels, Gorilla Gardeners, and Smart Cookin' Mamas. The Food Inc. panel we've been talking about was sponsored by the Virginia Eastern Shore Keepers, Astig Coast Keepers, Food and Water Watch, and the Environmental Studies Department at Salisbury University, as well as the Assateague Coastal Trust and the Arts Enter Cape Charles and the Palace Theater in Cape Charles, Virginia. Thank you for tuning in, and we hope you'll join us again next week. Soundbites on Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered at WEAA by Akisa Gunn and Zachary Coleman. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. For a complete podcast of our past episodes and information on how to contact us with your feedback and ideas for upcoming shows, please go to our website, www.ondelmarva.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA, the voice of the community, I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Take care.